Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience, and have a fantastic day.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
You're ready.
Exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars.
All of this could have been avoided if we followed my plan.
Broadcasting from Portland to Seattle and all of Oregon and Washington.
What was it you were saying about my voice?
It's loud, it's strong, and it's good, and I appreciate your support.
This is Honestly Provocative Talk with Lars Larson.
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.
Now, here's Lars Larson.
Be sure and keep that volume up.
On FM News 101.
It's going to be one of the highest rated shows ever.
KXL.
A place where Jews pray at the Western Wall, where Christians walk the stations of the cross, and where Muslims worship at Al-Aqsa Mosque. However, through all of these years, presidents representing the United States have declined to officially recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. In fact, we have declined to acknowledge any Israeli capital at all. But today we finally acknowledge the obvious, that Jerusalem is Israel's capital. This is nothing more or less than a recognition of reality.
A recognition of reality, and yet, up till this point, no other American president, not a Republican president, not a Democrat president, has been willing to do that, and especially not the likes of Barack Hussein Obama, who actually said he wanted to see the Middle East go back to the 1967 borders, when the old city of Jerusalem would have been off limits to both Jews and Christians. You would not have been able to visit unless you were a follower of Islam. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show. President Donald Trump with that announcement just a couple of hours ago, and I couldn't be happier. I think this actually is going to make a tremendous amount of difference for the world, for the Middle East, for the Palestinians, for the Israelis, for all of them. And yet you're seeing everybody in the world say, oh, no, because the Arabs and the Muslims say they'll cause trouble if we recognize that the state of Israel has a capital and its name is Jerusalem. Can you believe this? They effectively endorse the tactics of the Palestinians, who are a group of people, and I'll give you a couple of thoughts on them in the commentary, who actually endorse terrorism. And they say, if you do something we don't like, we will commit 3 days of rage. I'll tell you what, that would be a non-starter with me. If you were trying to work out peace between two groups and one group said, we're willing to have peace, and the other group said, no, all of those people have to be dead, we will not even accept that they have a right to live, I'd say, yeah, we're kind of at a non-starter position because the Palestinians will not accept. Imagine this in your neighborhood. I mean, you move into a new neighborhood and you, for some reason, have a problem with the guy who lives next door. And somebody tries to mediate it, and they go to your next door neighbor and they say, what's the problem? And he says, I'm not going to rest until my neighbor is dead. And then they come to you and say, do you feel the same way? And you say, no, I'm willing. He can live where he just has to stay on his side of the fence. So you've got one side that says, I want the other guy dead. And you got the other side that says, no, we're willing to live in peace. We've offered it dozens and dozens of times, and he's never been willing to accept it. What would you say about a conflict like that? You'd say the guy who demands his neighbor be dead is crazy. Anyway, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show and to Wednesday for Honestly Provocative Talk Radio for Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. I'm glad to have you with me. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. Our Twitter poll today, should states, Oregon and Washington in this case, and Idaho as well, should states include at least 3 different gender options on their birth certificates? Washington State right now is taking public comment on whether or not to allow a 3rd gender option on birth certificates. I think this is lunacy. A birth certificate is supposed to indicate what you were when you were born. All right, you can change a lot between there and your 21st birthday, but how you were born, were you born male or were you born female? Do you think there should be a third option? I do not, but you're willing to do. If you're willing to allow a third option, I'd like to hear what you have to say about why that's a desirable thing for the people of the Evergreen State. You can vote in the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and on our website, LarsLarson.com. In yesterday's Twitter poll, we asked you, would bigger paychecks fix the terrible high school graduation rates of Oregon and Washington? I said no. Bigger paychecks are not going to make a difference there, but I'm sure that a few of you thought it was yes. It was 7%, actually. 93% of the voters in our Twitter poll said no, bigger paychecks are not going to fix the problem. Only 7% of you said yes. I would have loved to have talked to some of those naysayers about why a bigger paycheck for a teacher would necessarily reduce the graduation disaster that is Oregon and is Washington. And while you're on the website, visit my trophy room at LarsLarson.com. Post a picture and a paragraph about your latest hunting or fishing adventure. Get the chance to win some great prizes and check out the other pictures there as well. We're going to get to all that in just a moment, but first, today's Northwest Nonsense.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense, presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
The capital of Israel is Jerusalem, a city with huge significance to Christians, Jews, and Muslims. The problem is, Muslims in the countries around Israel refuse to accept that the Jews have a right to live. The Palestinians in particular have promised to, quote, drive the Jews into the sea. For almost a quarter of a century, our country has had a law on the books to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. Bill Clinton signed the law when he wasn't otherwise occupied, but no American president till now has had the guts to actually move the embassy and provide a tangible endorsement that we know the location of the capital of our best Middle East ally, Israel. The U.S. has tried to play the role of independent third party, but failing to do this endorses the Palestinian side of the argument. The Palestinians who reward the families of terrorists. The Palestinians who've walked away from dozens of offers of an independent state of their own. The Palestinians who think the only good Jew is a dead Jew. Well, today, President Donald Trump announced the U.S. position. Jerusalem is the capital, and the Jews have a right to live.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Arm Yourself Gun Store in Hillsboro. Proudly veteran-owned and open 7 days a week. ArmYourselfStore.com.
Today's Daily Grill to the Attorney General of Washington State for filing 18 different lawsuits against the Trump administration. Hey, Bob Ferguson, isn't there work left to be done in the Evergreen State? And today's best email, but you can send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Papa Shoehorns, the perfect Christmas gift for everyone. On the web at PapaShoehorns.com. Lars, I thought you'd be interested in knowing my husband works for the city of blank and came home yesterday with a free laminated pass for unlimited TriMet bus and max use. No cost to him. He says all public employees get them. Isn't this ridiculous? And why are they publicly subsidized? I'll leave the name off of that one. Back in just a moment, you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
I am also directing the State Department to begin preparation to move the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
That is President Donald Trump just a couple of hours ago announcing the move that no American president has had the guts to make before him. But now he has done exactly that. He has shown to the world that the United States recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. I've invited Ivan Eland on, who's the Middle East expert and a senior fellow and director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute. Ivan, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me back on, Lars.
You don't think that this was the right move. Tell me why. Ivan? I don't know. Maybe Ivan's phone is messed up. Ivan, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. You don't think this is the right move to make for the United States?
Well, I think it's going to cause protests and violence. We'll see what happens. But it certainly is not making the Arab governments happy, and it pretty well will kill any initiative under the Trump administration to reach some sort of an Israeli Palestinian peace accord, although the chances of that were pretty low anyway, so maybe the costs aren't as great there. But I would say it's certainly a domestic political promise that's been kept to pro-Israeli groups, et cetera. So it's a good domestic win for Trump, but overseas, I think it's probably going to cause more trouble than it's worth.
Well, you issued a statement where you said the U.S. should not recognize the capital of Israel as Jerusalem or move the U.S. embassy there. You were pretty unequivocal about that. And this isn't just a promise that was made to pro-Israel groups. This is a promise that's been made by candidate Trump, candidate Clinton, candidate Obama, candidate Clinton before Hillary, Bill Clinton. This promise has been made by multiple commentators, including a lot of the top Democrats in this country. Schumer and Pelosi and the like have all said that we should recognize that the capital of Israel is Jerusalem. And they've said it explicitly. And then, of course, they don't have the guts to actually follow through on it. How do you know that if we've for 30 years refused or more refused to recognize Jerusalem as the capital, and it didn't, and apparently the peace process wasn't going anywhere, how do you know that making this move won't actually knock some of the parties back on their heels a little bit and get this thing moving again?
Well, I think Trump is, you're right, Trump is more honest than the other presidents. The other presidents pledged to do it to get votes, and then they didn't do it. But the reason that they didn't do it was, especially in Clinton's case, was because he was hot on the trail of trying to solve the problem of Palestine. Now, of course, he ultimately, I think that was a foolish move because he ultimately didn't do it. The thing fell apart in the year 2000 towards the end of his term. But as far as the current situation goes, the only way we're going to get a solution is if the U.S. is an honest broker between the two sides. And so that, you know, it's kind of the Palestinians and the Arabs are already suspicious that the U.S. Supports Israel rather than them. And that, you know, they have some reason for that since we give Israel almost $4 billion worth of aid every year.
But don't we also give an equivalent amount of aid to Egypt and a lot of aid to the Palestinian Authority? American taxpayers are on the hook for a bunch of groups in the Middle East, and it's not just the Jews.
Yeah, we do. We give aid to those groups, but it's not anywhere near $4 billion a year. Egypt gets a little over $1 billion, and the Palestinians don't get that much. So I'm not sure. I have to go look up to how much the Palestinians get, but they get a lot less than Egypt. So it's sort of one-sided in that regard. But the U.S. has made the attempt to be the honest broker, but this sort of blows that out of the water.
See, I got to tell you, Ivan,
we shouldn't even be involved in this. I think we should just leave the parties to their own devices and say, you know, we've been trying to do this for a long time. It hasn't worked out. And George W. Bush came into office and tried to do that to some extent, but he kept getting dragged back into the mess that most presidents get dragged into, some willingly like Clinton, but Bush was more, he was smarter when he first started out, but the politics got the best of him, and then he got dragged back in. So,
well, I want to ask you, Ivan, I want to ask you something else, though. You say we need to be an honest broker, like a neutral third party. The problem with that is...
I don't think we should be at all. I think that's what we tried to be. I think we should get out. I don't think we should be an. I don't think we should attempt to solve the problem. It's not our problem to solve, and I think we've tried to do this for ever since 1948, and it hasn't really worked out very well because the parties really don't want to get together.
Actually, I disagree with you. I think Israel has made all kinds of offers of peace, and the response they get from the Palestinians is, "We want all the Jews dead, and we want Israel gone." So, how do you negotiate with a group when one side says we're willing to strike a peace and they can have their own state, but they have to stop killing us, and the other side says, "No, we're only going to be happy when all of you are dead."
Well, of course, the Palestinians would say Israel's trying to slowly steal their land that they got by brute force in 1967. They're building settlements on what is supposed to be Palestinian land.
So it's supposed to be based on who, Ivan? Because when you say supposed to be, every single war, correct me if I'm wrong, between any countries on earth, when you end the hostilities, the lines stay where they are until a treaty is struck. And when the treaty is struck, it defines where the lines are going to be. The Palestinians have never been willing to agree to a treaty. Now, America had that problem with Mexico, and we struck a treaty, Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, and it settled where the borders would be. So until some kind of treaty is you know, resolves the end of a war, then you keep whatever land you took in the war. Have you seen it work differently than that anywhere on planet Earth?
Well, there's also an international legal problem with Israeli occupation, because you're not supposed to settle occupied land until the settlement is done, until the settlement is reached. So they're in violation of international law. And I'm not sure the U.S.-Mexican war is a good example, because James Polk ran U.S. troops into a disputed territory, which the Mexicans had a better claim to, and provoked the war to try to steal a third or a half of Mexico, which is what we did. So I'm not sure that that's a good analogy if you want to support Israel in this case.
Well, I do want to support Israel in this case, and I think that you have to get one side to admit that the other side has a right to exist. And the Palestinians have never been willing to do that, and the Israelis have always been willing to do that. So what does that
do? No, because if they admit that, they're never going to get any of their land back.
Well, why should they get? They might get some of the disputed West Bank back, but I think the Palestinians, so-called, who have never been part of a state, would like the whole country back. Do you think I'm wrong?
Well, the more radical ones, maybe, but I think, you know, most of the Palestinians are willing to keep the West Bank, and, you know, they've already got Gaza, so to speak, but the West Bank is, Gaza's not really worth much. It's the West Bank that everybody cares about. And, of course, 1967, Israel took the first military action, so Palestinians...
Because they were about to be attacked. Do you blame them?
Well, that's a little bit in dispute. I mean, Nasser was moving forces, but I think, at any rate, that land was grabbed with using force. And I think the Palestinians, from their perspective, they would say, well, you know, we have a claim to that land, and it was used to be part of Jordan. And, you know, Jordan is heavily Palestinian. There's more Palestinians in Jordan than there are Jordanians. So this was a Palestinian area. And I think that, you know, they do have some claim to the land. And unfortunately, you know, Israel sort of offering them a state that sort of a balkanized state.
They've been offered 98% of what they've asked for, even under Yasser Arafat. They were offered 98, a deal where they got 98% of what they were asking for. And it was never enough, because they famously said, we want to drive the Jews into the sea. I got to tell you something. If you're negotiating with people who aren't willing to admit that you have the right to continue to be alive, I think it's a non-starter position with folks who say you have to be dead for us to be happy. Ivan, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Ivan Elin from the Independent Institute, glad to have you with me. And I think this is an historic day by a president who had the guts to do it. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday, live on the Radio Northwest Network throughout the states of Oregon and Washington and Idaho, providing great regional talk and honestly provocative talk content for the Pacific Northwest. And it's always great to welcome back Miss Rachel Monahan. Rachel, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Rachel is one of the star reporters at Willamette Week, and she's written a story that is right up my alley. You know, the whole West Coast or left coast of America seems to be short of housing. And the government agencies involved in this say, we know how to fix it. We'll go out and raise a bunch of money, and we'll tell everybody how to do their jobs, and we'll be so much better off. And they've been doing that for a good long time. And now we're shorter of housing than we've been in a long time. But Rachel thinks she's identified some other cities around the world that actually can show the left coast of America, in particular Seattle, Portland, and Eugene, how to get it done right. So tell me about these cities that are doing it right, and then in the left coast cities are not.
So the story is occasioned by the city of Portland looking to create more housing in Portland by allowing for more development in single-family neighborhoods. This is a very controversial policy in some neighborhoods. It's welcomed in others, but it's called the Residential Infill Project, and the city estimates that it'll only increase the number of houses by, you know, less than 5,000, shy 1,000 homes.
In the next dozen years.
Yeah, over many, many years. At the same time, many, many, many more people are moving to our, many, many, many more households. 120,000 households are expected over roughly the same period of time.
Right.
So this, so their biggest idea right now is really, really small, basically. So I looked at six cities, and I can briefly summarize the ideas we drew from each of these cities.
Sure.
So they are Montreal, and the idea there is to build more row houses or attached townhouses, which is sometimes considered a less controversial option in Portland than a, you know, big old apartment building. Tokyo, which, like Portland, is mostly a low-rise city, but has allowed some really tall buildings to be built in some select neighborhoods of the city.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of opposition in Portland to height, but that might be one way for developers who are interested in building high to give more flexibility to developers. So Pittsburgh, the idea there is would be to set up our tax, our property tax system in a way that incentivizes development and doesn't punish people who actually develop. Right now, most property tax systems in the country, and Portland too, basically tax the value of the land that your house sits on and the value of your house in equal measure. In Pittsburgh, they tax on the land, or majority on the land, so that, you know, it incentivizes somebody who's sitting on a vacant lot or a parking lot to want to develop because their taxes won't go up that much. And they are paying for us, in a way, they're paying as if they had developed it already.
You know, you said something in that example that kind of caught my ear. You said, as a general matter, property taxes are based on the value of land and the buildings on it in equal measure. And yet, mm-hmm. what you're saying is, if somebody has a $500,000 lot and they put a mm-hmm. $1 million house on it, that they split the value between the house and the lot, $750 each. But that's not or do they?
I shouldn't say it that way. It's like the land is taxed at the same rate as the building.
Oh, I see. So you could tax land at a higher rate, buildings at a lower rate for the valuation. Yeah. And then what would happen is if you had an empty piece of land, you'd have a real financial incentive to get out and get something built on it.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
All right.
New Orleans, they have banned Airbnb in one of their neighborhoods, with at least advocates for that say they've seen a whole bunch of housing come back on the market. That means, like, you know, homes that were previously being rented out as hotel rooms essentially are now available for people who live in New Orleans. And then if you don't like any of these private market options, there's Singapore, where explaining what Singapore is, which is basically a autocratic nation state where they have built massive amounts of public housing. Their public housing is different from our system of it, but it's essentially the model of the government exercising more control over housing.
And maybe culturally that wouldn't work as well here because our public housing tends to turn into ghettos, right?
Well, I think that I wouldn't agree with that. I think that
you wouldn't?
A generation
Can you name
ago,
me a piece of public housing that's not a ghetto somewhere in America? Or even here in the Northwest?
Yeah.
You can?
Yes.
Great.
I would say that the public housing that has been built in the Pearl, and there's a relatively high amount of housing that public housing in the Pearl, or I should say
what?
publicly supported housing.
You mean individual apartments or condos within bigger buildings that are owned privately? No.
No. They're publicly built, highly regulated buildings where there's plenty of affordable housing. So yes, there are examples of that. But I would say that a generation ago we decided that public housing produced slums and that was bad, and so we moved away from that. But I think we've seen what happens when we go to the other end of that, which is a whole bunch of homeless people on our streets. So to move to the last example that I think you probably like that one too, is Chicago, which I used as an example of a place that allows developers to get, or not allows, but they have a process in place that makes sure that developers get permits much more quickly.
Gee, imagine that.
In Portland.
I mean, wouldn't that be a great idea here? Because I understand the average wait time for a developer, and I think Seattle's almost as bad, is a couple of years. So somebody comes in and says, oh, you need housing. Would you like me to build some? And we say, yes. And they say, great. Can I get a permit? And we say, yeah, in about 2 years. And that just seems crazy.
I think there are outside cases of places that have the developers who have had problems getting permits that have lasted longer than 2 years. As far as the building permit, which is the part of the process where you've, already gotten your designs approved, if you need that through the design commission, the actual building part process in Portland, as far as I understand, for the biggest buildings we're talking about, like skyscrapers, those take
which is mostly not housing, but okay, go ahead.
Oh, well, I mean, that's where a lot of our housing is going to be. It doesn't have to be skyscrapers. It's the taller buildings in Portland. Those take seven months to a year.
By the way, I did have a favorite line from your story, and usually I have a least favorite line, but in this case, I have a favorite line in a positive way, Rachel. All of our West Coast cities confront severe housing shortages. All of our West Coast cities have political debates that ignore the real lessons. The current dialogue ignores places that have built abundant housing and do not have rising housing costs. I loved that quote from Alan Derning, who's the executive director of the Sightline Institute in Seattle.
Yes. Four of the six examples are drawn from a Sightline article, a recent Sightline article. They got us thinking about this subject. So I think that is a great quote.
You know, the only one I wish you'd done, and I think I've mentioned him to you before, is the guy, Rob Justice, who's managed to build affordable housing without city subsidies, and even with the city getting in his way to a certain extent, and the city takes a look at what he does, which is about a third the cost of anything the city builds as publicly subsidized or public-private partnerships, and they say, huh, interesting. And then they move right along as though they didn't absorb the lesson at all, that this guy is a guy who, and it's not like he's got some patent on some secret way of doing it. He just goes out and builds housing, but he does it without all the razzmatazz that the city and the county seem to want to hang on to it that makes it so darned expensive. And I just wish they'd do more of that.
Yeah, I think that that's sort of a subject matter I definitely want to explore, like how the city is doing since our paper did a big story highlighting the high cost of affordable housing.
Uh-huh.
The reason that I didn't look at that kind of example is I was looking at places that, that have added supply rather than getting into the nitty gritties of like how our public housing process has failed.
Fair enough. Rachel, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thanks very much for taking the time today. You can find her story at WWeek.com, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Big developments going on all over. The president of the United States declaring that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. No other American president, not any Republican, not any Democrat, has had the guts to do that. Al Franken will stop being a United States senator tomorrow. We're about 99% certain that that is the decision, because now more than half of all the senators who are Democrats have come out and demanded that Al Franken step down, because this creepy old dude kept, grabbing the backsides of young ladies that he barely knew. And now the latest story is that when he was still in radio doing a talk show for a now failed entity called Airhead America, that this young lady was working with a congressman, and he had just interviewed the congressman. And after the congressman left the studio, that Al Franken went over. This guy is about my age, goes over and puts the make on this young lady and tries to kiss her on the lips and stick his tongue down her throat and all the rest of this stuff. And he says, this is my right as an entertainer. If you don't believe the story, it's at politico.com. And we were just talking about housing. Anyway, tomorrow, Al Franken's going to make an announcement. So I think tomorrow, Al Franken's going to announce that he is stepping down. He'll be replaced by the Democrat governor of the state of Minnesota. Nick writes in, he had heard the conversation I had with Rachel Monahan from Willamette Week about housing in the Northwest. And he said, Lars, I'm trying to develop a 71-lot single-family detached workforce housing project in Sheridan, affordable to families earning between $35,000 and $47,000. The state is now telling me that my land is a wetland due to the type of soil, even though it is dry 8 months a year, according to the city, has no standing water, no cattails, no nothing. The state will issue me a permit if I pay them $700,000 up front as a wetland mitigation fee, completely destroying the feasibility of the project. Meanwhile, Sheridan has a 300-employee RV manufacturing plant that's going to open any day, and as of October 1st, had exactly 4 homes available for purchase. Now, do you understand the problem there? The problem is not banks. The problem is not evil developers. The problem is government. When government says to a guy, hey, you got wetland there, you have to write us a check for $700,000. This is the equivalent of dealing with the mob that can say, we want you to build housing, but you have to write us a big check first. I mean, I almost think it'd be better to be shaken down by organized crime than to be shaken down by government. Organized crime at least doesn't try to kill the golden goose. They just try to get the eggs from the golden goose. Government tries to kill the goose. Let's go to Mike in Medford, listening on KMED. Hey, Mike, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Well, thank you, Lars. You and I are on the same page on this Jerusalem thing.
Good.
If you think back when Golda Meir was prime minister, there's a quote, was a really nice way of saying Palestinians are just clueless. She said that there'll be peace when the Palestinians love their kids more than they hate us.
Yep.
But what I think Trump did, if you go back, as you know, we were the first country to recognize Israel in 48. And he is just reaffirming that and sending a loud and clear message to the Palestinians and Islam in general that Israel is here to stay.
And there's no other way to interpret it. I mean, because if you say we want to negotiate, but one side says the other side has to die and go away, and we, as independent, you know, as an independent third party, say, okay, we won't recognize their capital. Because after all, a country that's about to be destroyed doesn't need a capital, right? Only a country that's going to stay there needs to have a capital. So as long as the United States goes along with this Palestinian insanity of denying that Israel has a capital for its country, a country, by the way, that celebrates 70 years of existence next year, as long as we go along that, we're siding with the Palestinians. And frankly, I would love to talk to some pro-Palestinian people. Most of them won't come on the show. And Mike, here's why. Because the first question I'd ask them is, what should you say about one side when they say the other side has to die to make me happy? And that's where it stops. And they'll say, well, that's not what they've said. And I said, I can find you tons of quotes from Palestinian leaders in the last year or two, going all the way back to the beginning of the existence of Israel, saying the only thing that's going to make them happy is that they drive the Jews into the sea. And why the kids on college campuses and all the popular lefties and the big celebrities in America side with these murderous Palestinians, I have no idea. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and emails on this very active Wednesday. The President of the United States announces a major change in policy toward Israel. Al Franken announces that he will give his swan song tomorrow. He'll come out with a big mea culpa. I'm so very sorry, blue, blue, blue. Well, you know what? He's not going to be a U.S. senator anymore. 30, count them, 30 of his Democrat colleagues in the United States Senate. I would expect by the end of the day, if it is not at 48, which is the total number of Democrats in the U.S. Senate calling for Al Franken to resign, I will be very, very surprised. This guy has had enough accusations leveled at him and apparently backed up by individual testimony of people saying, this is the guy who went out and put his hands all over me, that sort of thing. He's got to go. Well, I have a feeling that he's going to be gone tomorrow. In fact, he skipped out from the Senate today. He didn't show up for any of the votes, but he's going to have to resign at this point. And then we've got a lot of other things going on here in the Pacific Northwest. This one got under my skin. A federal judge is allowing Washington State to proceed with its lawsuit to seek to force one of the nation's largest privately run immigration detention centers to pay minimum wage for work done by detainees. U.S. District Judge Robert Bryan today denied the GEO Group's motion to dismiss the case. The for-profit company runs the Northwest Detention Center in Tacoma. The judge says that GEO failed to show that Washington State's minimum wage law, as it applies to detainees, is preempted by federal law. He found that the other arguments GEO made could not be resolved this early in the case. GEO had argued that Washington State did not have the authority to bring that lawsuit. The Washington Attorney General's office says it's entitled to enforce the minimum wage law against GEO, just as it's entitled to enforce it against any other company in Washington. GEO pays detainees $1 per day for tasks like janitorial or kitchen work. Washington's minimum wage is $11 per hour. Now, let's unpack this just a little bit. The people who are being detained in this detention center in Tacoma are people who are illegally in the United States of America. They are being prepared for deportation from this country. We are supplying to them as taxpayers three hot meals a day, a place to sleep, medical care, and I'm sure a lot of other services that I can't begin to list, but just about anything they might need while being held in custody. The fact that it's a private company doing it, or if it was a government agency that was doing this, the fact that they allow some of these detainees to make a dollar or two while they're in custody, even though they're in custody, costs the rest of us money. The American taxpayer pays this company and would be paying a government agency either way. I mean, if we're going to detain people, their three hots and a cot and medical care and everything else has to be provided, whether it's a privately run company or a government agency. I think what's going to end up happening here is that people held in custody are not going to get to work. Because this private company, if you tell them, if these people are going to be told to do janitorial work or kitchen work, you can't pay them a dollar a day. You have to pay them $11 an hour to clean up after themselves. Well, it'll probably do one of two. It'll probably do two things. Number one, the company will say, well, then we're not going to have that work done by detainees. That's the only sensible thing that a for-profit company could do. And it would be the only sensible thing that a government agency could do. Then we're going to have to hire private employees to come in and do the work instead. And when you have to pay either the detainees or a private worker, a lawful worker, not an illegal alien, $11 or $12 an hour to do janitorial work or kitchen work or whatever, then the cost of locking up those people in custody is going to rise. And you know who's going to have to pay that? The American taxpayer. We're going to have to pay the increased costs of either providing the workers as private sector workers or paying these illegal aliens or criminal alien detainees before they are, you know, put into custody. So the end result of this is going to be to cost the government more money to be able to take care of the problem of dealing with people who shouldn't even be in our country to begin with. So a federal judge is now going to let the lawsuit go forward to demand that these people be paid $11 an hour. I think this is absolutely crazy. By the way, Terry Weibel writes in and says, Lars, for the first time, this is on Facebook, and our Facebook page is The Lars Larson Show. For the first time, I actually saw the sanctuary state of Oregon in action. I received a ticket for not stopping at a red light. I went to court, and when I went to court, the person right before me was a Latino man who had never had a driver's license since he's been in Oregon. The judge just smiled and let him go to a night class. And then when I got up for my hearing, I had to pay $190. That goes to show you that the undocumented illegal Mexicans in Oregon will and always will get the benefit of the doubt. I just thought I'd let you know. Thanks, Terry Weibel. Imagine that. You show up at court, you have to pay a fine. The guy in front of you has never even had a right to drive, but he got tagged for driving without a license, without insurance, without all those things. And what does he get? He gets a night class because the judge thinks we have to do something nice for this guy. Oh, and should private companies have to sue the state just to be able to build up a business and hire workers, the backers of one of the biggest coal terminals in North America have now filed a second lawsuit against the state of Washington over a coal export terminal. This is a terminal that would involve a private investment of $2/3 billion. All of this private money, none of it coming from the government. Millennium Bulk Terminals Longview filed the lawsuit in Thurston County Superior Court on Monday against the State Department of Ecology. The lawsuit says that Ecology violated public records laws by withholding the basis for its findings in a key environmental impact statement. A county hearings examiner last month relied on that statement when he denied two permits that Millennium Bulk needed for its Columbia River coal dock. Ecology described 9 adverse impacts, from noise pollution to impact on tribal resources. The hearings examiner added a 10th impact, greenhouse gas emissions. Millennium says the state did not provide the data that it used to estimate greenhouse gases and particular emissions. I imagine because they're talking about where the coal is going to be burned, which is likely going to be China, which means it's not even going to be in this country, and the Department of Ecology doesn't have jurisdiction in China. Let's go to Tom in Vancouver. Hey, Tom, welcome to the Lars Larson Show, and what's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, thanks for talking to me.
I'm glad to do it, but we got to get you. We got to be able to hear your phone, and it sounds like you've got a loose connection.
Is that better?
That's somewhat better.
How's that? Better yet?
Yeah, better yet.
All right. That geo thing. We're providing them with services, correct? Three hots and a cot, basically, and medical
care. Three hots and a cot and medical care.
Then why can't we charge them for that and credit them $11 an hour for the work they do?
I think that's a terrific idea, and unfortunately, Tom, I'm going to have to break this call off because that clicking is going to drive everybody nuts, but that's not a bad idea. Say, if you're in custody, we're going to charge you for the cost of keeping you in custody. Now, the only question is whether or not that might be, it might end up being not constitutional under a debtor's prison kind of interpretation of what's going on. Well, could you get away with charging the detainees for room and board while they're being held? Not a bad idea, though. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you. We've had some really inventive ideas when it comes to this idea of GEO. GEO is the private company that runs the detention center in Tacoma, where we lock up hundreds of illegal aliens, preparing them for deportation from America. Now, while they're waiting for deportation, GEO, the private company that is contracted with the government to house these people and to confine them, they put some of them to work. And they say you can earn $1 a day by doing some kitchen work or some janitorial work, that sort of thing. And now the state of Washington is trying to force them to pay minimum wage of $11 an hour to these illegal alien detainees. Now, I've had a few of you write in, and like Forrest, who wrote in, he heard the guy who called in and said, well, why don't you charge them for their three hots and a cot? And he said, I think that guy's idea was great. You can pay them exactly enough so that at the end of the day, they would receive $1 after they paid for their stay. Well, here's an idea that I want to throw out, because I know the first thing is going to happen is if you're detaining somebody, you have to feed them and you have to provide them with a minimum level of care, right? I mean, you can't let the cell or that room that they're housed in get down to 30 degrees at night. You've got to heat it. You've got to provide food and housing and all that. But you could provide the bare minimum and say, here's your place to sleep. Oh, you'd like a mattress. Okay, we can supply a mattress. That's $5 a day. You'd like a pillow and a blanket and a sheet. Okay, we can supply that. There's a charge for that. We're going to feed you Nutriloaf. Now, I've never been in jail as a prisoner, but I've been in jail to interview people as a reporter. And they've told me about Nutriloaf. It's a penalty that they sometimes use where Nutriloaf is, imagine this, if you went home tonight to have dinner and your wife took everything you were going to have for dinner, the broccoli and a little bit of roast beef and some other things, and just chop it all up, run it through a blender, put it in the kind of pan you normally make banana bread in, and bake it up. That's Nutriloaf. It has all the ingredients of life. It's not very tasty, but it does provide the necessary calories, carbohydrates, and protein for life. You will never say, I'd like some nice Nutriloaf if it were on the menu somewhere. Feed them Nutriloaf and water and say, now, would you like to buy a nice juicy hot dog, or would you like to buy a steak or a hamburger? We can sell that to you. And all you do is you make it an equal kind of economic transaction. You want to get something better than Nutriloaf and a flat spot to sleep on the ground, then you can pay for it. If the state of Washington wants to play this game and say, you got to pay these illegal alien detainees $11 an hour for doing some of the work to take care of their own environment, that is, the janitorial work and kitchen duty and all that, if they're going to demand $11 an hour, fine. They're just going to have to pay for it. And the math will probably work out so that they don't get anything back more than what they have to live on. Let's go to Jennifer in Battleground. Hey, Jennifer, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I guess my concern with this whole minimum wage for the illegal detainees is what's to say that next year, 5 years, 10 years from now, that the remaining correctional institutions in the state of Washington specifically aren't going to then try to go ahead and get minimum wage as well.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, then what is the incentive for those who are not incarcerated, but who may have a criminal record? What's going to keep them from committing crimes if they are unemployed when they know if they go behind bars, they can then get $11 an hour or whatever the minimum wage is at that time?
You might actually be making it an attractive work environment, right?
Right, exactly. I just don't see how this can incentivize anybody to truly correct their ways and become an asset to society. Instead, I see it as being almost an incentive to the unemployed to just go behind bars because they get three meals and minimum wage.
Three hots and a cot, and you got a warm place to sleep every night and a hot shower and everything else and some real fun bunk mates. Jennifer, thanks a lot. I think you're absolutely right. Let's go to Connie. Hey, Connie, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
I was just wondering how you or that person that wrote about the Hispanic man that had never had a driver's license, how anybody knew he was illegal.
How he knew he was illegal?
Yes.
I think it was because he watched the interaction between the judge and the man and that he drew the conclusion that since the man was driving a vehicle and had never in his life had a driver's license, that he communicated to the judge that the reason he didn't was he was in the country illegally. That was what I got from the email.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that he was illegal.
He may not have been. Do you think there was reason to believe that he was just a regular American citizen who happened to be in his 20s or 30s and driving vehicles but didn't have a driver's license and all that? You think that's a possibility?
Well, I think it could very well be. I know people that are in their 50s that are American citizens that have never had a driver's license.
Are most of them, if they're in their 50s and I understand it's possible, especially if you live in a big city and you depend on mass transit, but most people who work for a living find that having a driver's license is a real asset toward getting other jobs.
Well, yeah, it could be a real asset, but I know people that take taxis.
Taxis?
And also, I know people that buy beaters and drive illegally.
Yeah, and that may be. Connie, I guess I'm wondering, I don't know the other details as to why this man drew the conclusion, the man who wrote me the email, that the gentleman ahead of him in court was an illegal alien, but why are you so concerned that we not inappropriately apply that label to somebody?
I guess because I don't think it's right to assume someone is committing more of a crime than driving without a license. I just don't think that that's truly the American way.
Well, because driving, when you say more of a crime than driving without a license, you realize the consequences of driving without a license. It means, number one, you may not have insurance. Number two, you're not going to have respect for or even know the rules of the road. You may be a real, literal danger to other people on the road. I think of it as a pretty serious crime.
Well, I do too, but I'm not saying that the judge was right to give him
night school.
Yeah.
It sounds like I've lost Connie. I don't know where she's going, but there she is. Let's go to naysayer Paul. Paul, welcome to the program. Where do you and I disagree, and would you be willing to hold through the break if we don't get done with your point by the bottom?
Yes, of course.
All right.
Sounds like you've never been in jail yourself.
Not as an inmate, no. Never have.
That's great. I just got out of the military. I did 20 years. Actually, 18 years.
Thank you for your service.
Yes, I was in jail for a year.
Why were you in jail for a year?
A bunch of traffic stuff when I was younger, and I ended up at OSCI for a year.
Well, that's not jail. That's prison.
OSCI is jail, prison. Yes.
No, it's prison. Prison is where you stay more than a year. Jail is where you stay less than a year. Jail is usually about local offenses and being held preparatory to trial. Prison, which is what OSCI is for serious offenses where you get sentenced to more than a year. Hold that thought for just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And by the way, let me bring you up to date on a little something that is inside baseball. We had scheduled an interview for exactly this time. I'm going to get back to the caller here in a moment. But we scheduled an interview with Eric Jacobson, who is the communications manager for the Woodland Public Schools. We scheduled it yesterday. It was scheduled to happen right now, at this moment. And then I got an email 8 minutes ago saying that they were canceling out of the interview. But would we like to schedule it for later on today or maybe sometime next week or on another day? Now, I don't think much of that. When somebody makes a commitment to do an interview, you should go ahead and do it. Now, if you've had an emergency, I could understand that. He indicated no emergency. He just said, we're busy with some other things and we can't do the interview right now. How about we schedule for another time? What I had planned to talk to Eric Jacobson about is that there was a press release put out by the Woodland Washington Schools in which they said that they were offering free classes to teachers there to teach the teachers Spanish because there are 280 Hispanic families in the district who don't speak much English. And what I wanted to ask the Woodland Schools spokesman about was, why don't they teach the parents of those families English rather than teaching the teachers Spanish? Because I know that we hear all the time that teachers have such full schedules that they can barely get all the things done that are the bare necessities for the things they have to teach the kids. So I would suspect that they do not have the extra time to go out and learn all the different languages that might help to accommodate all the different parents. You might have to teach Spanish, Vietnamese, Russian, Ukrainian, and a few other languages just to be able to accommodate that. Why they're doing this, instead of telling the parents of these kids, you need to learn English. You're in the United States. Your kids are in the United States. This is the language of success. I'd love to talk to Eric Jacobson about that. I'd love to talk to the superintendent of the Woodland Schools. But they canceled out 8 minutes before they were due to be on the air. And all we wanted was not an in-person interview, but an interview on the phone. We'll see if we can reset it. I mean, we're willing to do that. But I hate it when people do this. Schedule and make a commitment, and then they welsh on the commitment. That makes sense to me. Let me go back to naysayer Paul. Now, Paul, you were talking about spending time in jail, and you had been in the military. How long?
I understand if you were loosely basing something. Yes, I was in there for about 20 days less than a year. But, yeah, prison is different than Multnomah County Jail or any county jail. I've been in both on that same thing. I was in Multnomah County for about a month, and then I did my 11-something months at OSCI.
Okay, so what does all of this have to do with the illegal aliens locked up at the Tacoma Detention Center and whether or not they make minimum wage for the work they do?
Not specifically that, but as I told your screener, you're a bomb thrower. I get it.
What do you mean by a bomb thrower? You mean I throw out provocative statements, but they're true? So in other words, I don't come out and I say, hey, what do you think of the weather today? Or how about them Ducks? Or how about them Seahawks? You're right.
Yeah.
So what would the point of a talk show be if you simply said, let's talk about warm and fuzzy today? Because that's not very interesting.
That's why I listen.
Thank you.
I listen. I don't agree, but I listen. So that's just a truth. Anyway, let's go on from there.
Well, I don't know why you went there, but why don't we get to the point you actually want to make?
Yes, I'm trying to. It's very difficult.
Well, we've been at it 5 minutes now, and you're nowhere near it. So tell me what it is.
Let's forget the bomb throwing. You're continually pretty much bashing prisoners and prisoner rights. And, you know, having done some time, what I would say to you and your listeners is when you're in there, you're doing time, you're paying for something. You don't want to give the prisoners reasonable food, then you're going to pay more for medical care.
Well, I said reasonable food. I said minimal, though. I think every jail.
You're talking about bologna sandwiches. That's what they get right now.
I think that'd be fine.
Your hero, Sheriff Joe, who I follow because I can't stand him, that's the same kind of thing. It's like, let's treat everybody as poorly as we can, and we're so cheap with the prisoners. And then.
Well, Paul, can you tell me why you'd want to make jail a place you'd ever want to go back to? Wouldn't you want to make jail and prison the kind of place where when somebody's done being there once, they say, I never want to go back there again?
Yes, but you're not listening to my point, Lars.
Well, tell me what the point is.
The point is, when you're there, when you actually do time there, and the doors are clinking all night, and people are fighting all the time, and the food is crappy, and you're stuck with three people in a two-person cell, and you've lost all your rights, and you can't have the internet, and nothing's happening, you're suffering in prison, believe me. So maybe you should go and spend a couple nights at some point.
Why would I want to do that? I don't commit crimes. Unlike you, I chose not to commit crimes.
I understand, and I haven't done it again, so they worked with me, right?
Good.
However, you're going to face that person in your big truck driving to Vancouver, wherever you go across the bridge, or breaking into your house or whatever, some angry person, because they're extra angry because of the way they were treated.
Now we're getting to your point. Okay, now let me see if I understand. Let me see if I understand your point. If we could make prison or jail more like staying in a Hilton hotel, then when criminals confront us, you said they're angry because they've got a lousy, they don't have Wi-Fi, as you mentioned. They probably don't. They do have cable TV at the big house. They do have cable TV, but you say they don't have Wi-Fi and they're not happy with their roommates and their room isn't like a Hilton hotel. So if only we made it more like Club Med, then you would have happy criminals. And then when they confront me at midnight inside my house as they're stealing my stuff, that they'll be in a happy mood because they'll understand.
They'll be smiling. Yeah, they'll be smiling. Maybe they won't knife you. Just have you and your listeners Google the European prison system and take a look at it.
I don't want to. I don't want our system to be anything like
yours. You don't want to know. That's right.
I know about it. Paul, you're missing it. I know about the European prison system. I said I don't want ours to be anything like it. It's far too lenient on criminals.
Yeah, and I wonder what's much more successful. Very strange. But that's okay. You're okay. I'll keep listening.
I appreciate it. And you have a nice day as well. Glad to get your calls at 866. Hey, Lars, let's go to Larry. Hey, Larry, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, thanks, Lars. Yeah, I just after, you gave old
Geraldo Rivera a shot that, and when he was talking to him,
because he said nice things about Matt Lauer and was trying to defend Matt Lauer.
Yeah,
it was kind of stupid thing to do.
On Fox or any of the others.
I think he maybe they've decided to give him, his walking papers. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either because I don't,
Do you think he was worth anything on the?
No. Hey, I didn't have any use for that guy.
Yeah, well, then we can say good riddance to him. You know, he has been a guest on this program before, but not in a long, long time. Let's go to David in Vancouver. David, you heard us talk about detainees and whether or not detainees at the Tacoma Detention Center for Illegal Aliens should have to pay these people $11 an hour if they're asked to do kitchen tasks or janitorial work.
Well, my point, the only thing I really got to say about it is that they're going down a real slippery slope here. Because if you start paying detainees $11 an hour to do kitchen work and janitorial work, what happens to the next time when one of our prisoners in state prison or county jail decides, well, I sweep the hallways and I get 70 cents an hour for sweeping the hallway.
Yeah.
But I should get paid that minimum wage that these detainees get paid because I'm in the same boat as they are.
I'll tell you what, it could happen. You could see the prison systems forced to pay those kind of wages. And you know who ultimately pays the wages is the taxpayers, because there isn't a prison out there that generates a profit. So, if they demand to be paid that kind of money and the work has to be done, it probably is still cheaper to use the inmates. But if they're going to go that direction, David, it's been a long time since we talked to a sheriff who was the sheriff in Klamath County more than a decade ago. And Tim was his name, but God, Tim, not Everhart. It was Tim. In any case, I don't recall his name. He started charging the inmates for condiments, not condoms, but condiments. So he was charging them for mustard and ketchup and relish and mayonnaise and things like that. And he ran a relatively small jail. And he drew in about $30,000 a year in that small jail by just telling the inmates, we're going to give you basic food, but if you want any of the little extras, it's going to cost you. And maybe that's what they're going to have to do, is if we have to pay inmates minimum wage, then the inmates are going to have to pay for just about everything they want to buy. And it's going to cost them enough to recover all the money we have to pay them. We'll make it a zero-sum game to leave them enough at the end of, say, the week to buy a bag of potato chips and a pack of cigarettes. Maybe that's what we'll leave them.
Yeah, that would be about the only solution to that situation.
There's the problem, is that you've got people like the previous caller who say, look, why are you being so mean to these people? They committed crimes against society. They put other people's lives and safety at risk. Do you expect us to give them three hots and a cot and medical care and education as a thank you and then not be tough on them? I want them to go to jail and then come out and never go back again. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, at least one of my listeners liked that last caller a lot. Treat the prisoners nice and they'll be nice to you. Your caller said that we need to treat criminals nicer in prison or they'll be angrier when they're committing crimes. He calls that extortion. Yeah, Corwin, I'd have to call it extortion as well. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails. And let's go to a naysayer. Boaz is on the line from Woodland, Washington. Boaz, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larson. I'm not a very smart man, so I have a few questions to ask you about these so-called undocumented.
I'll do my best.
I just call them terrorists. They're not supposed to be here. So you're saying they're going to pay these guys $11 an hour. But if they're not here illegally, how can they get a paycheck, let alone how can they pay taxes on that money?
Well, how about before they... Here's another question that I think will be a little more to the point, but I'll answer yours. They can't get the money. I mean, if you're here in this country illegally and you don't have a green card, you cannot be legally employed at a job. And for the life of me, I don't understand why the state of Washington would bring this lawsuit to try to get people who are in the country illegally paid a wage at minimum wage when they can't be paid a wage at all legally.
that's what I'm asking. It's like, isn't that kind of rewarding them for coming over here? That's what they wanted in the first place?
Yes.
With a little bit extra coin?
Yes.
But, yeah. So
exactly.
It doesn't even make sense. How could they even be legal?
They're not, and they shouldn't be paid a dime, and I couldn't agree with you more. But do you actually, you're on as a naysayer. Do you disagree with me about some part of this?
Yeah, I disagree that they should get paid.
Oh, okay. I get the point now. Thanks very much for the call. 866-439-5277. Let's go to Cosmo. Hey, Cosmo, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars.
Yeah.
I do disagree with you about one thing. I know one prison that works in the black that makes money.
Which one is that?
I got out of there for it's Texas Department of Corrections.
The Texas Department of Corrections?
Yeah, they have the solution down there. When you're out in the hot sun working all day long with a snuff-dipping, tobacco-chewing boss riding shotgun behind you, telling you, yeah, you got three words to say, yes, sir, boss, and no, sir, boss. And trust me, you don't want to go back.
That sounds like a great way to run things.
That's right. I got out of there 40 years ago, and I never went back. And I was down there for 18 grams of marijuana on an eight-year sentence.
Less than half an ounce, about half an ounce of marijuana back then, right?
It was back in the 60s. But that's what they need out here. The fact that they're paying anybody just slays me.
It kills me as well, and I thank you for the call. By the way, folks, I just heard about this development. This just came down the wire. The House of Representatives today passed legislation that would allow people to use permits for carrying concealed handguns across state lines while boosting the background check system. Despite bipartisan support for enhancing background checks, the bill passed only on party lines, 231 to 198, due to Democrat opposition to concealed carry reciprocity. Six Democrats voted with the Republicans to vote for the package, so congratulations to those six Democrats. Let me guess that not a single one of those Democrats who voted for nationwide reciprocity is in the Oregon or Washington congressional delegation. I'm willing to bet they all came from other parts of the country, and that's a sad statement. Let me go to Patrick. Patrick, what's on your mind today? Welcome to the program.
Hey, Lars. First-time caller, long-time listener. I just wanted to make a comment from that previous caller he wants, you know, prisoners treated, you know, like regular citizens.
Yeah.
And 30 years ago, I stole a car in Grangeville, Idaho, and I was caught 100 miles later.
Yeah.
And I was put into a very small jail. I think there was three guys.
We're close to the break, so be aware of that.
Okay. Anyway, they treated me like crap, which was great because it made a huge impact. I was the last person to use the disposable shaver. Once a week, you had to shave, and with no water.
You don't want to go back to that. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get back to your phone calls and emails shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. A few months ago, in Anacortes, Washington, not far from the San Juan Islands, there was a huge fish farm there, 300,000 nearly mature Atlantic salmon who escaped because of the structural failure of one of the ocean pens or the Puget Sound pens. And now the question has been raised whether or not we should allow raising salmon farms at all or having salmon farms at all. And Jim Walsh has joined me, who's the state representative in Washington State and a Republican from Aberdeen, because he has introduced legislation that would ban the farming of Atlantic salmon. Representative Walsh, it's good to have you on the program. Tell me why you want to ban the farming of salmon.
Hey, Lars, it's good to talk to you again, because it's a danger to the native stocks of salmon and other fish that we have here in the Pacific Northwest.
So you don't see a safe way to be able to do this at all?
Not right now, Lars. You know, we've had a couple of hearings in Olympia where we had the principals from Cook Aquaculture, which is running the several Atlantic salmon operations currently, and other people who have been involved in the industry.
Yeah.
And we asked some pointed questions. I did on the committee. about why this happened, how this latest escapement happened, and how we could be assured it wouldn't happen again. And the answer is they're not exactly sure how the structural failure occurred or why. And I guess I can appreciate that, the candor of it, but that doesn't make me very confident that any precautions they're taking will prevent it from happening again.
See, there's part where, before we even get to the part of this about it being salmon, is the part that bothers me, because there are lots of examples of industrial failures that have happened over the years. I mean, there have been, most recently, there have been some industrial failures in self-driving cars. And I have a feeling we'll see more of them. We've seen industrial failures in wind farms, you know, for electric power generation. And I wouldn't argue for throwing out those technologies simply because of a structural failure at one point, and especially before we know what caused it. You know, was it bad maintenance? Was it bad design? Was it bad construction? Which one was it? And if we don't know, we're just going to simply say then you can't do the activity at all, especially when it seems to me that farmed salmon is a way to make salmon a whole lot more accessible economically to Americans and to create jobs.
Well, the farming of Atlantic salmon is an industry. It creates some jobs, but not a ton. These things are true. But I would have been more inclined to take a slower approach if the people running the fish farms had been able to give us some real answer to what happened. The I don't know answer just is troubling to me. And so I think we need to get out of this business quickly. There are other proposals being discussed and being dropped, which will phase out a prohibition over a few years. But I just think that this is an immediate risk to our native salmon stocks. And mind you, I mean, these Atlantic salmon, they're a different species than the Pacific salmon, several species of which we have here in our sound and our river systems and the ocean. And I believe that these Atlantic salmon, as they're being raised on the farms, are a real threat to the native species.
Can you show that there was some damage done by the release of these 300,000, that has actually damaged the native stock?
Well, that's still being quantified.
But Representative Walsh, Representative Walsh, you just gave me the same answer that you faulted the salmon farms for giving. We don't know.
We do know there has been some damage. We don't know how much damage there's been, and we're waiting to quantify that. But any damage to our stocks, which are already down, the stocks of our native salmon, the salmon runs that we're having among native species are down so much. I just think it's like a person who's got a depressed immune system. You know, they can catch a cold and die from it because their immune system's already depressed. And our salmon stocks, our native salmon stocks, are like that. They're like a person with a depressed immune system.
The other thing I question is the whole definition of what a native salmon is, because as you say, you've said that we can increase hatchery production of native salmon. Well, are hatchery-produced salmon native salmon?
I believe they are. They're drawn from native stock, which are, you know, indigenous to this area.
So do you think
Atlantic salmon or not?
Do you think an awful lot of Northwest fishermen would agree with you? Because I've had these arguments over the last 20 years, too, with people saying anything produced out of a hatchery is not a native stock. It's not a native fish.
Well, most of the fishermen I know and people I talk to in my district think that the DNA is the same. And as long as the DNA is the same, these are native fish. The DNA of these Atlantic salmon that escaped recently is not the same. It is a different fish. It's a different species. And the cycles of growth, the growth cycles for these farmed fish are different than the native fish. And the fish that were released recently were almost completely grown, nearly mature.
Yeah.
And at that point in time, for most of our most desirable native stock, the Chinook and the Kings, they're still in the juvenile stages. And when we release these fully grown Atlantic salmon, they're hungry. They're turned out loose into our water systems, and they can predate. They can eat the juveniles, the fry, the little fish of the native stock that are feeding and growing.
Because they're coming along at a different stage of their growth.
Correct.
I get that. So, but if you're going to eventually phase out the prohibition, in other words, at some point in a few years or a number of years, you're going to allow farming again, how will you expect them to, I guess, perfect the technology, or at least make the technology a whole lot better so that it's not subject to failure, or is likely to fail, as this one was, if they're not going to work on it? If you don't let anybody do it, then, and you can't generate any revenue from it, there aren't going to be people out there researching how to make these pens work. Will there?
Well, that's not true. We've got people growing farm fish all over the world, and they are constantly working on their technology for raising farm fish. And if a producer wanted to raise native stock in a farm environment, we'd be happy to look at that. It's just the non-native stock that we want to put the hold on.
Of course, if they raise native stock, then they wouldn't be able to harvest it the way I assume that that this company would have been planning to do, right?
We're not sure about that. They could raise native stock to their own schedules. They defend the Atlantic salmon as being more controllable, more malleable. So that's their justification for growing that species here. But this is the Pacific Northwest. I think if we're going to be farming fish, we should be farming fish that are drawn from native stock.
And not bringing in, other kinds of DNA from other regions of the world.
Correct.
Even though Mother Nature does that from time to time, all the time.
We are certainly pushing Mother Nature's hand by releasing several hundred thousand non-native fish into our system here.
All right. So you're fairly confident this is going to pass a legislature?
There are going to be a couple of different versions. I think there may be a little negotiation, among the different bills, but I think some form of a prohibition will be passed. And this is the bright line. This is the clearest, strongest statement for prohibiting the Atlantic farmed salmon. And we just thought it was a good idea to get it out there quickly and strongly. And, we'll go through the legislative process and we'll talk to the other sponsors of other bills. And I believe some form of a prohibition will be approved because the risk is just too great.
Representative Walsh, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much for the time.
It's always good to talk to you, Lars.
Thank you, sir. Representative Jim Walsh from Aberdeen. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, the reports late today are that the former Saturday Night Live funny man, as the New York Post calls him, an accused groper, Al Franken, has now gone to his home in Washington, D.C. to talk about his fate with his family. He plans to make an announcement tomorrow, and virtually everyone in politics expect that Al Franken will come out tomorrow and announce his resignation from office. And then his replacement will have to be named by the Democratic governor of the state of Minnesota. Let's go to Rick in Gaston. Hey, Rick, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
How you doing, Lars?
I'm doing quite well, sir. Thanks for asking.
Well, a couple callers ago kind of touched base on this, but with this trying to pay these guys this minimum wage, are you kind of doing an end run around the law? Because if you pay them, you got to legitimize them by getting them a green card.
Yep.
And you got to legitimize them by getting them a Social Security card to be able to pay them legally. I mean, far be it, a liberal trying to do an end run around the law. But isn't that basically what they're trying to push through?
It sounds like it, except that there is no way to quickly get somebody a green card. If somebody had a legitimate green card, it's like that Catch-22. If you remember the movie Catch-22.
Right.
If you have the green card, you're legally in the country and then you can't be detained. If you're being detained, then you're not in the country legally because they're about to deport you and you're not eligible for a green card, which means you can't work. And all that this private company has been doing is flipping these guys and gals a dollar a day which is a courtesy amount, I think, that they could probably spend at the commissary in detention if they're doing some kitchen work or some janitorial work. It's a small incentive to do it. You put them on a regular paycheck, and that private employer will have to, well, they'd have to fill out an I-9 on each one of those employees. I have to do that as an employer, and an I-9 can't be filled out on an illegal alien because they can't, because you'd be encouraging them to sign a document, and by signing the document, they'd be committing a federal felony by claiming to be in the United States able to work legally. None of that works. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Jenna. Hey, Jenna, welcome to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Hey, Lars, how you doing?
I'm doing quite well today. You called in because you heard us talking to the state rep about salmon farming, and he wants to outlaw it in the North, or, well, in Washington State for now.
Well, I'm kind of calling about B.C. up in Columbia, but how salmon farming goes, when they take those salmon and just, I'm a little upset about it.
You're upset about what? About salmon farming?
How they are processing and getting rid of the waste in these plants that are processing massive amounts of salmon.
Well, do they dump it back in the ocean?
Yes, 100%.
And what's wrong with that? The ocean's full of dead fish.
We all know that blood carries what?
Well, blood carries disease, but are you talking about, I mean, if you're worried about blood in the ocean, believe me, because of predators and everything else, there's plenty of blood in the ocean all the time.
Isn't there? I understand that, but what's happening when this blood goes back into these canals, what's happening to the...
Into what canals?
Well, up in B.C.
Okay. Aren't they dumping the fish waste back into the ocean? We just went through that.
It's in canals, so all the fish that are running back up these things, up the canals, are just going through disease. So,
yeah, and I'm not as familiar with what's going on in B.C. I'll tell you what, shoot me an email about that, a link to a story, and I'll be glad to research it some more. But as I understand it from all the scientists I've talked to, salt water, especially the level of salt that you've got in ocean water, is one of the best disinfectants in the world. You can take...
It's more up. The factories are more up, so it's like in between fresh and salt, so it's not totally salt water.
So brackish water? That's where you get a mixture of fresh water and salt water. And you're saying that they should be dumping it farther out to sea?
Yes.
Do the environmental agencies of... I thought the environmental agencies of Canada were pretty solid.
I thought so, too.
But they're allowing it, so if they're allowing it, should we conclude that it's meeting all the demands of Canadian law?
We can believe so.
Well, I guess. Well, I'll tell you what, till I see some proof. Otherwise, send me something and I'll take a look at it. I'll research it on my own. Let's go to Mike in Vancouver. Hey, Mike, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, long time. The sheriff you're thinking about is Tim Ebinger.
Yeah, that's it. Tim Ebinger, thank you for reminding me. The man who charged for commissary condiments and made $30,000 a year back from the inmates, which he could use to fund more deputies.
Right. In fact, when I was at the sheriff's office there, Tim was still a police cadet. But that's a while back. But the thing is, you know, we were talking about, you know, one of your prior callers was talking about corrections and punishment or whatever.
Yeah.
And in our old jail there, and I think you've seen it because our paths crossed when you were broadcasting down on that area too. But we had a sign over in the jail that says these inmates are here as punishment for their crimes, not for punishment. Now that whole word is gone, and it's all about corrections and look where things have gone.
And rehabilitation and restorative justice and all the rest of this warm, fuzzy stuff.
Yeah, and that old jail was not a place where you really wanted to be. It was built in 1924. It was cockroach infested. And, you know, I've had to put a few of my high school classmates in there, and they didn't want to go back to that place either. So, you know, maybe we should make jails not as hospitable as they are.
And Mike, my theory has always been that jails and prisons should be made as legally and constitutionally uncomfortable as they can be. Is that, you think that's a good way to put it?
Yeah, I do. And that's always been my belief. And, you know, even the individuals that I had put in there And, I mean, I've seen those conditions. It stinks. It's worse than a locker room. It smells pretty bad. But you come out of there with a whole new respect for life, and there are those that it doesn't matter. You're still going to have high recidivism rates because they don't know any better.
Well, that's a good point. Mike, thanks very much. By the way, I just got this word. Now, if you want to, you want weird, I was just asking one of my producers, one of my coworkers, if you were Al Franken, wouldn't you want to have resigned already at this point rather than sitting there like the sword of Damocles is hanging over your neck or something? There's a report just now. Senator Al Franken is discussing with his family whether to resign from office, but no decision has been made. His office has officially said Franken's team has also denied a Minnesota Public Radio report. I guess that's the place where they have that Prairie Home Companion with the pervert at that show. No discussion has decision has been made on whether he will resign. So as an official statement, the Al Franken office says he has not decided yet whether to resign tomorrow. Amazing. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get back to your phone call shortly. We're live all over the Pacific Northwest on the Radio Northwest Network, and I'm really glad to welcome to the program from the Woodland School District, it's Superintendent Michael Green. Superintendent Green, thanks for taking the time today.
You're welcome.
Now, I'm curious about this because I got this press release the other day from your school district, and it said that your school district had identified a problem, that there are 280-some-odd Hispanic families who don't speak English very well at all, and the solution that one of your English language learner outreach coordinators had come up with was, rather than teach the parents English, you want to teach more of your teachers to speak Spanish. And so they've started doing once a week classes to try to do this. Can you tell me why that's the best solution to this problem?
And I'm not sure the frame that you're operating with is a fully accurate frame.
I'm reading it right off your press release, so I'm depending on your press release.
Understood.
Yeah.
So the situation that we have in yesterday's show, there was some conversation about the fact that we're not teaching children English, and the truth could not be...
No, I've never said that you're not teaching. By the way, are you on a speakerphone by any chance, Mr. Superintendent?
Yes, I am.
Can you come off of that? Because to everybody who's listening around Oregon, Washington, Idaho, it sounds like you're coming from the bottom of a tin can, and I don't want them to think less of you because you sound that way.
Oh, is this better?
Oh, so much better. So,
okay.
No, we did not say that you're not teaching them English. What we said was, the better solution, rather than teaching all the teachers to speak Spanish to accommodate the non-English-speaking character of the parents, why not teach the parents of these kids English so the kids can learn English at school and go home to an environment where they can speak English to their parents?
So let's read the last line of the press release.
All right.
In which it very clearly says, Wells also offers classes for Spanish parents to learn English. Now she is working to connect both groups of students so they can learn from each other. This is not about actually teaching staff to communicate with parents in Spanish only. This is about connecting with our community. The individuals, there was a comment made yesterday about this being a union-driven thing. Actually, nearly all of the people who are engaged aren't even union members.
Are your teachers union members?
I don't believe there are any teachers in that group. Our HR person is there. We have a technology person. We have a couple of secretaries who are dealing with folks who come in and may have a question. And it's an opportunity to just engage and be able to say welcome. And we're glad you're here. And, find enough communication that we can help folks address issues and challenges and help their kids be successful in school.
Superintendent Green, how long does it...
that we deal with is that adults learning a second language is a very challenging and long process. Our job is to educate children.
Mm-hmm.
Our job, and we do it very well, is to work with kids on the development of English language. And part of that is partnering with the parents and connecting with our community so that we can support learners in the classroom, day in and day out.
All right, Mr. Superintendent, what would it take if you fully immersed English language learners in English, how quickly could you get them up to speed to where they could be put into a mainstream classroom and simply do their language, do their lessons in English? I understand from California years ago that they found the most kids could be brought up to speed in English in about a year. How long does it take in the Woodland School District?
That is a question that is most dependent on the age in which the child enters school. The change in the human brain is very rapid and very different. So if a child is entering kindergarten as a primary Spanish-speaking child, even by this time of year, those kids are operating in an English-speaking classroom with some success. It takes, 2 to 3 years for a child who enters a kindergarten to really become fully fluent. If a child comes here when they're, say, in 9th, 10th, or 11th grade, it takes many, many more years, and it has more to do with the way the brain learns language.
So you're saying that even if you were to take a 9th, 10th, or 11th grader and put them into full immersion English, that it would take 2 or 3 years of full immersion English to get them up to where they could operate, with some capacity in a regular classroom?
Are you asking about the younger learners?
No, I just said if they're in 9th, 10th, or 11th grade, would it take 2 to 3 years if you put them in full immersion English?
The representation that that students coming in are not integrated is inaccurate. We have, in our high school, we have some ELL students who may have some of their core instruction taught in a bilingual classroom, mm-hmm. but by and large, we integrate students without regard to their native language across the curriculum.
Well, if most of these kids are coming up to speed in English well, then why the need to teach a number of teachers to speak Spanish, as is being done in this press release? And I guess the reason I'm asking that is, Mrs. Superintendent, I hear all the time the teachers don't begin to have enough time to do all the things they should do or have to do to fully take care of the kids. And now we're putting one more thing on them, learning a foreign language, which, as you point out, learning a foreign language for an adult teacher in their 20s or 30s or 40s is a difficult thing to do. So we're going to lay one more thing on top of them when they're already short of time to get the things done they need to do.
Boy, I appreciate that perspective and the challenge that our employees have. It is a very, very challenging job, and that's one of the reasons we have not done. And this is totally by invitation. If you want to go learn, that's great. There's no requirement. There's no compulsion. There's not even been individualized recommendation. Just an email. Hey, I'm willing to teach conversational Spanish class. Come on out at 4 o'clock if you want.
And this is being taught, what, just as a volunteer thing? No wages paid to the teacher at all?
Absolutely. It's totally volunteer. It's totally on your own time. Come on out and learn if you want.
All right, so both by the teacher and by the students in this class?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, it's about connecting with parents and with our community.
There was a term used in this press release that you sent out. It said it's not about picking up the entire language. It's about validating diversity. What is that?
It's about when a child enters the school and they don't speak the predominant language, mm-hmm. and you've got a kindergartner walking in the hall, if you can say bienvenidos to them, you're connecting with that child. That doesn't mean we're going to teach that child in Spanish, but it's validating that child and saying, welcome to our school. That's what that means.
All right, that's validating diversity.
That's validating a child. It provides comfort. It engages them in the learning community.
You don't think they'd be comfortable if you said, good morning, welcome to our school? And they might think, well, I know I'm being spoken to in English, but then again, I know I'm in an English-speaking country. So I've already come to expect that people address me in English.
Certainly.
And that addressing them in English would not validate their diversity?
I think we're saying the same thing. I will say bienvenidos, welcome. You know, we say it in both languages.
Why?
Because we care about the human that walks in that door, and it's connecting with them, and it is validating them as an individual and honoring their own experience when they come in.
And if you spoke to them in English, Mr. Superintendent, you'd be telling them you don't care about them?
If you're a child walking in and you come from a family that doesn't speak English and your sole experience is in another language and you walk in that door, it is a terrifying thing. It gives us the opportunity to connect with a child, to say welcome to them, to have some level of engagement, because that first day of kindergarten, gosh, I don't speak any English. That's a scary, scary thing.
Do you find that these families that you deal with are on a path to learn English?
Many of them are, yes.
Many of them, but some of them don't.
I can't speak for every family. I know that in our community, predominantly English speaking, in order to be successful in the economy here, a level of English is required. There are very large numbers who come out for ELL classes and learn and really want to learn English.
Yeah, because Mr. Superintendent, you're saying the same thing I say. I tell people that English is the language of success. It's the language of every scientific paper in the world. It's the language of air traffic control. It's the language of most foreign trade. It's 70 or 80% of the internet. So it's very much a science, because every scientific paper has to be submitted in English, no matter who it's submitted from or to. I mean, it could be a German scientist submitting a paper to a Japanese scientific journal, and it has to be submitted in English. So I very much agree with you. And yet we run into illegal aliens in this country who are in this country for a decade or more and still can't speak much English at all. And I wondered whether or not your experience was that most of those families are on a path to learn the language so that they can help their kids be successful.
Yes, and that's why we have supports that the school district and our local community college, Lower Columbia College, support families and support individuals in the learning of English.
Hmm.
And
well,
there's huge interest and investment on the part of our Latino community in learning this language.
Mr. Superintendent, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Glad to have you on. Superintendent Michael Green from the Woodland School District. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to get your phone calls and emails. And Superintendent Green was a good sport to come on. I was glad that he had told us that he listened to my entire show yesterday so he could catch all the things we had to say about some of the ELL programs. But Tony writes in, Lars, this guy, if I ever heard somebody saying something without saying anything at all, it comes to mind. These are the kind of people I despise. Such a delicate snowflake, not saying anything with merit. And then this, Ryan, Lars, unbelievable. Say good morning to a kid who knows Spanish is just an uncomfortable thing for them. We're so backwards on this PC validation of people's emotions on all spectrums, it makes my head hurt. I don't go to Germany when I'm told Guten Tag, cower and cry in the corner. I lived in a foreign country for a year and I don't speak the language. After enough times of being talked to in their native tongue, it lit a fire under me to at minimum learn the basics, and even took it further to have deeper conversations. I don't think speaking to a primary Spanish speaker in English is a harmful thing. This country functions on the English language, and if they want to integrate and succeed, they better put the effort in and actually learn it. To your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let's go to John in Happy Valley. Hey, John, welcome to the program and the Radio Northwest Network.
Hi, Lars. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
So it sounds like the superintendent hasn't immersed himself in the classes he suggested himself that he be offered.
That's possible. I should have asked him if he speaks Spanish. I don't know.
Well, I can tell you from his accent, he doesn't, because my wife and I are both second generation from mixed families. Both of our mothers are from a different country, and they came here legally. And my children speak perfect Spanish and perfect Korean, and they get slammed at school for speaking in native tongues all the time. They go, we don't speak English, we don't do this. But what I've noticed is with the illegals, or with the people that could be or could not be illegals, their favor to speak their native tongue all the time. And the only reason I could tell they're illegal is because they're from places in Mexico and have a different dialect in their Spanish, because we don't speak Mexican Spanish, we speak European Spanish. So where's the fairness in that?
No. I listen, I'm with you. And the gentleman who just emailed in a moment ago, he said, when you go to a foreign country and you get greeted in the foreign country's home language, does that hurt anybody's feelings? You know, only if you're a very delicate snowflake. Otherwise, you say, gosh, I'm in Israel, they're speaking to me in Hebrew. Or I'm in Germany, they're speaking to me in German. For goodness sake. Let's go to Stephen. Hey, Stephen, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hey, thank you, Larson. Yes, I am in disagreement with Michael Green. I think his term that the Spanish-speaking course that's being offered for the teachers is voluntary is misleading. Underlying, I think it's mandatory, and it's more based on what I'm seeing in California, but it's working its way up here. If you're seeking a job in the public sector like a teacher or in state and local government, if you cannot list on your application that Spanish is a fluent second language that you can speak, you're not getting the job.
Which means American citizens who don't speak Spanish will be treated as second-class citizens. Right?
Correct. And I also think that the number of the members of Latino communities not learning English is a lot higher than he might be implying as well. But, yeah, if you can't put on your application that you can fluently speak Spanish as a second language, you're not getting that job.
I think you'll find that if you talk to police officers who police some of the heavily Hispanic parts of the Northwest, they will tell you that there are people who've been here for years and even decades who haven't bothered to learn much English at all. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.